Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
All we had was, like, performances that were graded.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 155, a talk with Robert Sput Seawright. Sput is a drummer, keyboardist, and producer who consistently plays with the top acts in the world. Hip-hop fans have heard his work with Snoop Dogg, Timbaland, and Kendrick Lamar. But in addition to that, the Dallas native has played with everyone from Erykah Badu to Justin Timberlake, to Celine Dion, to his main gig, the instrumental powerhouse band Snarky Puppy. But before all that, Sput got his start as a part of Kirk Franklin's Grammy-winning group God's Property, which he played in as a teenager, and whose lineup, incidentally, reads like a who's who of future star musicians, including To Pimp a Butterfly producer Terrace Martin, Janet Jackson's longtime bandleader Daniel Jones, and Erykah Badu's musical director R.C. Williams. We talked to Sput at the Breeding Ground Studio in Brooklyn. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should listen to our interview with another great musician and studio whiz, Anton Pachansky, on episode 147. Also, consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a fraction of our listeners contributed just a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's your favorite drummer, whether you knew it or not, Sput Seawright.
I know your first drum set, in quotes, was a bunch of pots and pans when you were a kid. How old were you when you started making noise on them?
Probably one or two years old, actually. I mean, it was, I remember my mom cooking, and I would be in the kitchen with her, and the stove was away from the cabinets, and she would put out pots and pans to preoccupy me while she's cooking. And I would be over it, and she'd give me two spoons, and I'd just be beating on pots and pans, you know, listening to the radio, you know.
That's amazing. And when did it go from there to kind of playing in churches and stuff?
Well, I mean, you know, her and my father were administrators in the music department at the church, local church I went to. And they played. There were the choir directors. Both of them were choir directors. Both of them played organ. And my dad didn't play organ out in public. He played at home all the time. Played organ and drums. And so music was just around me. You know, it was there in my family. You know, in the immediate family. You know, home and situation. So yeah, I was playing at home a lot, and then would just be exposed to the musicians at church. And then as older I got, and then I got opportunities to play in church.
Right. You know, it wasn't just your church, right? There was kind of a whole scene of gatherings and different kinds of stuff you were doing.
I mean, like, there's, you know, in the faith, I was a Christian. I grew up in a Christian home. So we had these denominations that, you know, that would have, this one particular denomination was, Kojic, they called it the Kojic, and Church of God in Christ. And every year they would have a summer convention in different cities. You know, every year would be a different city. So every year they would have a summer convention, and then a convention in November called the Holy Convocation. You know, and the summer convention was called UNAC. And these summer conventions, we would go and we basically would do like all these, it's like a week of services, you know, and they would have different services for youth and for adults. But I mean, like, this is where I met most of my musician friends out, you know, out there, you know, because we were all coming from different parts of the States. And everybody brought the identity of their region musically to the table. And so I was exposed to a lot of different forms, different styles, and different areas of music just from that, you know, alone playing gospel music and then going back to my hometown and taking whatever I was exposed to there, and vice versa for most of the other guys, like Lil John Roberts, a drummer, Gordon Campbell, and, you know, Robert Glasper, Chris Dave, all these guys.
These musicians Sputt met as teenagers would grow up to become incredibly accomplished. Drummer John Roberts has played with everyone from Prince to B.B. King to Common to Elton John, and has appeared on TV shows like American Idol, Saturday Night Live, and The Queen Latifah Show. Gordon Campbell has drummed with Beyonce, Jessica Simpson, Whitney Houston, and more. Robert Glasper is a Grammy-winning jazz pianist and producer who has also collaborated with rappers including Kendrick Lamar, Black Milk, and Q-Tip. Drummer Chris Dave went on to play with D'Angelo and Adele, among others.
You know, we were all in those conventions and really, well, you know, in those church forums and running into each other a lot.
Wow. And where did God's Property, your mother started that, or?
Yeah, me and my mom, it was a group of kids that wanted to sing at Arts Magnet from the beginning. And we ventured out of the school because the school really didn't allow such an outlet for that, you know. And it kind of kept us out of trouble, you know, honestly. But it was like the cherry-picked, you know, kegs of dynamite, you know, out of all of the, I mean, everybody could sing, write, play. And we kind of, I just kind of put, assembled a group of musicians together. And it was me and this guy named Myron Butler who kind of ran it. But we were kids, you know, so we needed, in order to get the consent of other parents, we needed chaperone. So, you know, we were trying to get our parents to get involved to just kind of, you know, get everybody's, all the other parents okay. And, you know, so my mom, she's a music teacher. She was a choir director. She worked with youth. She knew what she was doing. So I asked my mom to come aboard and help. And it was kind of some tension, to be honest with you, with some of the other chaperones and other parents, because she just, all the kids just kind of gravitated towards her.
Mm-hmm.
So that situation didn't work out. So we just decided to start our own group. And that's when God's Property was formed. But essentially, it was the same group. It was just everybody just came over to our group, you know. So, and the rest is history, man. We went on to do a record with Kirk Franklin. We actually did three records with Kirk Franklin, and but we did our own record with him once he got signed to Interscope, and it was an amazing record. It was Stomp. And it broke all kind of barriers of the time period, and it landed me my first Grammy.
The album God's Property from Kirk Franklin's New Nation won the Grammy Award for Best Gospel Choir or Chorus Album in 1998. I feel like having some church up in here.
Come on, chat. Which is insane. You were, you know, like you said, in high school, probably, you know, 18, 19, when the real level success happened. How'd you hook up with Kirk Franklin in the first place?
Oh, he's a hometown boy. You know, he's from Fort Worth. I'm from Dallas, which is like, they call Dallas the Dallas Area Metroplex, the DFW. So we ran across each other a lot. You know, I was playing in most of the choirs that he was directing, and I mean, he's just a hometown guy, so we were always interacting at some point or another with him. And he took a liking to the group because the group was really exciting and very youthful, and those are the things he wanted to connect with. So,
yeah. And so you have this happen to you at 18. You're having hit records and winning Grammys and stuff. And I was curious about that. Did you just kind of assume, like, hey, this is easy. Like, everything I do becomes a hit. It's going to be like this for the rest of my life.
No way. I mean, you know, it's funny being young and having it happen the way it happened to me, because it's like you don't expect that. So your work is not geared towards that achievement. You know, you're just doing what you love to do, and we're just having fun. We thought that we put out a decent project. We were kind of happy about it. We thought it would be a good record to most people because we felt good about it. But we had no clue it was going to do what it actually did. And when it did, it's like this shock value that you have to get over. And it's a process of declining from, okay, wait a minute. We just did something super big, you know. And I think for a long time, you know, to be very transparent, like a lot of the business side of that time period of my life was so dark and so misleading, you know, on my part. And, you know, that I didn't really have time to really, I didn't get a chance to really enjoy it.
Right, because your mom ran into some legal issues with, I don't know if it was Kirk or his label or his,
well,
his,
I mean,
whatever.
To be honest with you, you know, it was just, it was a case of just not, it was just ignorance, just not knowing the business. And my mom, of course, being the adult, was the one that everybody went to. She was just as inexperienced as I was in the business, on that business side of things,
yeah.
You know. But she did the best she could to protect the group. So she put herself on a limb and signed contracts for as her being the sole provider for the group, and it was a conflict of interest to the record labels. So that were, you know, they were trying to just like pick everybody out as they pleased, and it was really the regular shady business that was happening, and you know, all the time, you know. But it was just such a large group of people, it was kind of hard to kind of maneuver. And she was like the mother bear that just held on to her guns, and they didn't like it. And so, I mean, they really played on her ignorance and her lack of knowledge in the business. So a lot of money was being thrown around in different places, and the word recoup was being thrown around every time.
Every time you were like, where's my money?
Yeah. So we went out on a tour as God's Property for 6 months, and we were getting evicted, cars repoed, and we went out for free for 6 months. And very quickly, as you know, we learned that kids, how you know, we learned the real business of the industry, that we couldn't be just excited anymore, you know. So I mean, and the story is pretty intense, you know, but you can just imagine with all of that going on, you know, that it was you have that going on, but then you're rising in success, and we're in the midst of going to all these award shows, the Billboard Awards, the Image Awards, the Soul Train Awards, Lady of Soul Awards, MTV Awards, the Essence, the, you know, all sorts of awards, and performing in all these places, the Dove Awards, the Grammys. And in the midst of all of this stuff, you know, we were in turmoil and we were in crisis. And when we did the lawsuit, they were trying to take the name of the group, and we did the lawsuit, and that's what the lawsuit was actually about. It was written up as something else, but the lawsuit was about the ownership of the name, and we won that. But, you know, in a nutshell, you know, we didn't really benefit financially from that, that record and that time, you know, those shows and stuff like that. So, I mean, it was just too much. The kids were, all of us as kids were really traumatized, and everybody just kind of gradually went their separate ways.
Did it cause tension with Kirk, this whole thing?
It did. It caused a lot of tension with Kirk in the beginning, you know, because, you know, Kirk was busy being his own artist in his own world of artistry that he kind of didn't realize or per se knew what was going on with us, because we never actually traveled and toured together. We always toured separately, and we would do spot days and do the award shows together, But as far as touring, we never really toured together. So he didn't always know what was happening with us. So, I mean,
it's interesting, but it makes sense listening to the record you did with him. He's there almost like an MC, ceremony leader, preacher type, and not so much with singing.
Joy cometh in the morning.
Joy comes in the morning.
Troubles, they don't last always.
Troubles, they don't last always.
Ah, for there's a friend named
Jesus.
I assume he was involved in the songwriting end or whatever, but performance-wise, he's not super involved in those songs.
Yeah, but he wrote and produced most of all the songs on the record, you know, most of them. But the thing is, keep in mind, Kirk had his own group. He had a group called Kirk Franklin and the Family. So there was always going to be a limitation of how far he could go with, you know, I'm pretty sure it was a quiet sense of turmoil, you know, in his artistry, because he was already known and established as an artist, but then he met up with these young group of guys, and that record did, you know, hit the top of the charts and stuff like that, and it was probably, I can imagine he would, like any artist, would want to venture towards that,
right,
you know, direction to perform with us and do more, but he had obligations in days to honor the group that he already had.
Right.
So it was really a conflict of interest, really, on both sides, I felt like. But thank God, man, time heals all, because we've managed, you know, most of the people have managed to stay in the industry and be successful. Some of the musicians, me and Sean Martin, and a guy named Bobby Sparks, all of us have managed to still stay relevant in that situation and still work with Kirk today.
I was going
to
say, Sean is his MD most of the time
now. Sean is his producer, his right-hand man.
Yeah.
Sean Martin is a keyboardist and composer who is back with Kirk Franklin as his musical director and co-producer, at least when he's not composing his own music or working with Erykah Badu. Bobby Sparks, in addition to playing with Franklin for 2 decades, has also performed with Herbie Hancock, Ray Charles, Tower of Power, and a who's who of gospel stars.
I play drums on all the records. And I mean, so it's still, you know, time has allowed for healing and us to still be able to make music and work together. So,
yeah. I want to take it back just for a second. You mentioned the Arts Magnet school you're in, Booker T. Washington School. So for people who don't know that school, what is it?
It's called the Booker T. Washington High School for Visual and Performing Arts. So we call it Arts Magnet because that's just a short way to say all of that.
Right.
But it was a school that specialized in the arts. It's the best way I can describe the school would be to think of the TV show Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you know who I am? Remember my name.
Fame.
I'm going to live forever. I'm going to learn how to fly.
Well, what you saw in that TV show is what we lived in high school. There were, like, when the bell rung, you saw boys and girls in leotards dancing down the halls, people, orchestral players walking down the halls playing their violins, people playing saxes, you know, people doing visual arts on the side, you know, I mean, and it was people acting, practicing their lines, you know, you saw all these things and you heard all of these sounds, you know, in conjunction to arts on a regular basis, like every day. And it was really a beautiful scene. It was really a beautiful thing to be a witness of for 4 years and to be a part of. So
why do you think that school? I mean, we can, you know, run down the alumni list, and it's, you know, obviously, you know, you and a lot of the guys who were in God's Property and but also, you know, Erykah Badu and Nora Jones and
Roy,
you know,
Hargrove.
Tons of people in other fields. Yeah, Roy Hargrove and tons of people. What is it about that school?
Well, I'd say at the time, like the school, especially at during that time, the school kind of like the Dallas area, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, they were reaching out to all the talent, the loads of talented kids that were there, and they were just cultivating the arts by just, you know, recruiting and making sure that they were getting the best of the best, a best of the crop there, and then molding and shaping them into, you know, the musicians that and the artists that we've become today. And I'd say from that standpoint, that's probably the gist of it. I mean, that's why that school was so special, because, I mean, you gave up a lot as a high school kid to go to that school. You know, you gave up sports, you gave up extracurricular activities that normal high schools have, pep rallies. We had none of those things, you know. All we had was, like, performances
right. That
were graded. You know, I mean, like, it wasn't, you know, you didn't really have all of these, you know, these regular high school experiences that most high schools, you know, have, like, you know, just normal stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the people in God's Property who, you know, you've kept in touch with and worked with as recently as this year, but who's not normally associated with Dallas, at least anymore, is Terrace Martin.
Terrace Martin is a producer and musician from Los Angeles. He's best known these days for his work with Kendrick Lamar as one of the guiding forces behind To Pimp a Butterfly. However, he's also put out some well-regarded solo projects and has worked with a ton of rappers, predominantly from the West Coast, including Snoop Dogg, Game, YG, Warren G, Corrupt, and our episode 107 guest, MERS.
What was working with him like back then? And have you been surprised to see him become like the West Coast hip-hop guru that he's kind of become?
No. Terrace Martin, first of all, Terrace Martin is like my brother. Like, his mom raised me. So I met him when he was 13 or 14 years old. And we clicked on all cylinders. I was like 3 or 4 years old. I'm like 3 or 4 years older than him. But, I mean, it was kind of weird how somebody that younger, we clicked. And, we recognized immediately that we were both on the same level, you know, as in terms of musicality and in terms of what we liked, our taste in music. And we met at a Soul Train Awards ceremony, and he had been hired to play in the band for Sean P. Diddy Combs.
Wow.
In the big band setting.
Puffy, hold me down, baby. Only female in my crew. And I kick it like a player do. Pull the trigger too.
He was like just chosen in a big band, and I was also, and we were running into each other in high school at these things. What is it called? I guess it would be called a convention as well, called IAJE.
Oh, the Jazz Educators.
The Jazz Educators Associate. It was like this event that happened every year, and we would run into each other there because our schools would be competing for downbeats and stuff like that. And we all sat. I remember we all sat on a row. It was Robert Glasper, Sean Martin, one of the Strickland brothers. It was Terrace Martin, myself, Kamasi Washington.
Washington is a saxophonist and bandleader who also worked on To Pimp a Butterfly and has collaborated closely with producer Flying Lotus and bassist and producer Stephen Thundercat Bruner. In fact, Washington, Terrace Martin, and Thundercat were featured in the April 2016 Playboy article, How Jazz Saved Hip Hop Again.
Wait, this is really interesting because it's like it's
incredible.
Amazing. It's,
yeah.
I'm missing somebody very important and I can't think of who it is right now. But it was all of us, man, sitting on the front row at this one performance, and it was Kenny Garrett. I'm sorry, our Kenny G, the jazz version of Kenny G, the real Kenny G is what we say. But Kenny Garrett, Jeff Tane Watts, and Nat Reeves, which was a trio, a jazz trio.
Kenny Garrett has been called the most important alto saxophonist of his generation. He is best known for his work with Miles Davis, but has also played with Art Blakey, Marcus Miller, and more, and has put out almost 20 solo albums. Garrett's backing band that day had equally impressive resumes. Jeff Tane Watts is the longtime drummer for both Wynton and Branford Marsalis, as well as jazz piano legend McCoy Tyner. Nat Reeves is a bassist and educator who has played with John Scofield, Pharoah Sanders, Pat Metheny, and more.
And we sat on the front row, and that performance changed all of our lives in such a way that after that performance, we, as youngins, we would not stop until we found a room where we could have a jam session. And we went into the room and we had a jam session and they kicked us out of the room. And we stole pieces of the drums and went out in the hall and had the jam session in the hall all night, like 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And that was years ago. And yeah. I look back now and I see all of us in the industry doing what we're doing. But Terrace was a part of that. And that's how our lives ended up being for the next, you know, up until now. You know, we were always having experiences. So I would invite him to come to Dallas and hang out with me for like 2 and 3 weeks out of the summer. I would just put him on a plane and fly him out, and we'd hang out together, and we'd go around and really, I played in the clubs in the Dallas area, and I would have him play with me, and we would write music and doing music and really pushing each other, you know, musically. And he would do the same when he got older. He would fly me out, you know, to his place, and we would do vice versa. We just kept going back and forth. So he was doing the time where God's Property was performing. So I was like, yo, just come play with me, you know. And he was in that band, you know. We were traveling the world, doing concerts and stuff. And it was in that, you know, it was doing the time period actually where things wasn't so bad. It was like when we had new management and we wasn't associated to the label, but we still had a little momentum. And we would get booked to do certain events and stuff like that still. And it was actually the first time we would actually get paid to perform. And it was under our own management.
Nice. So, you know, one of your influences, early influences, who I actually hadn't heard of, and I wanted you to talk about him, was as a drummer for you, was Joel Smith, who played with the Hawkins Family. What was it about his style that grabbed you when you were coming up?
Oh my God, musicality, man. He played with such a grace. Jesus Christ is the way.
No one.
I mean, I remember as a kid, I mean, like, you listen to a record playing on a record player and, you have the choice to hear so many things. You have the choice to hear the guitar player, the drummer, the keyboard player, or the singer, or the horns, or whatever's going on. And only thing I could remember, or the thing that stood out the most to me in musicality as a whole, was the drums and his way of playing drums. The sound of the drums and the command of his groove, and then the at the same time the finesse that he possessed, you know. And I think that's always overlooked in the gospel world. That was always overlooked, you know. But and if you would take it to the R&B world or the pop world, you know, he was up there with Steve Gadd.
It's a bit of a tangent. We wanted to point out that Steve Gadd is one of the greatest session and studio drummers of all time. He's worked with Simon & Garfunkel, Steely Dan, Eric Clapton, James Taylor, and more. His performance for Paul Simon's 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, heard here, has been sampled by Eminem, Common, Kool Moe Dee, Absol, and former Cypher guest DJ Quick, among many others. But now back to talking about Joel Smith.
He created intros, legendary intros. He would play in such a way that innovated drumming for that genre, you know, so for the gospel drummer. So it's really, you know, his influences was actually people of other genres, like jazz, you know, jazz drummers and musicians and stuff like that. So he like kind of just innovated the gospel genre by bringing his influences over.
That era of kind of the 70s, you know, mid to late 70s, would end, which, you know, I know was an era you studied. Mm-hmm. You could probably now blindfolded still write out transcriptions. Stuff from that era. When you were, you know, probably getting into your teens, a lot of those groups started coming back in different forms in rap records.
Right.
How did you feel when you heard that? When you're like, oh, I know that groove. That's, you know, whoever, you know,
what?
Whatever jazz record or funk record they would sample or soul record.
To be honest with you, man, I remember just thinking to myself, oh, wow, the music is changing. So I really didn't connect it as much as that because, you know, mind you, I was born in the 70s. So a lot of the music that I heard was by default. It's not by, it wasn't me searching or me being a part. You know, I was still a kid, you know, I was born in 75. So it was just there. The music is there. So my point is, it's in you, it's internalized, but you don't really get it until you are able to grasp, you know, what it really is from your studies or, when, you know, there's just the age where the bell ringer goes off and you're like, oh, wow, that's genius. You know, that's, you know, and I started really getting into Prince and For You and all those records that I was born to. Eighteen years later, you know.
So when the sampling stuff started coming around in the early 90s, you didn't necessarily associate it with
with sources or references. I was like, wow, the music is changing, you know, and I was fascinated with that change. I was fascinated with how I witnessed evolvement in the way, you know, music was changing and, you know, hip hop was actually becoming something different and new, but I wasn't really a fan of it at the time, you know, and not because I wasn't a fan, like I didn't like the music or anything, but it's just, it wasn't where my interest of study was. So,
right.
Yeah.
Makes sense. And so, you know, to move on to some of the hip hop stuff that you started getting into, maybe like 2003-ish, you start playing with Snoop. Is that the right time frame, more or less?
Maybe before that.
Well, before that?
Yeah, it was maybe in the end of 2000, 2001.
Oh, that early. Okay. Yeah. How'd you first get connected with him?
Well, once again, my good buddy, Terrace Martin.
Makes the West Coast, know, king over there.
Right. So we, you know, we kind of did the same for each other. You know, he came to Dallas a lot, and I decided to move. Once he graduated high school, I decided to move to L.A. And so we made a plan for me to move to L.A. So I moved to L.A., moved in with him and his mom, Rose, who's my godmother. And, we basically was like the two bad children, you know, in the house that ran amok. You know, we built studios in her basement, and we just kind of just took over a house, you know. And we were determined, you know, we were determined to make music and produce together. And that's when we started a production team where we was just producing, making beats and doing all this stuff, you know. An opportunity came where there was a MTV paired up with Paramount Films or whatever. And they wanted to do a TV show on Snoop Dogg. And it was going to be called Doggy Fizzle Televizzle. Doggy Television, whatever. Yeah. Doggy Fizzle, yeah. Television or something like that.
What's crackalacking, y'all? Welcome to Doggy Fizzle Televizzle. And I got some f***ed up shit for y'all today. And I'm going to be playing with my band, the Snoopadelics. You know what I'm talking about? How we get down in a real special way.
And so they needed a band. They needed, like, it was going to be like a talk show. And they needed a band to play in and out. And, you know, just like, it was going to be like talk show style where you have the live band interacting and me and Terrace was called to do that. It was like a five-piece band, and I was the piano player in the band.
And, did that end up happening? Did that end up airing?
Yeah, it aired. I mean, obviously, it only had one season.
Right.
But it was fun. It was a fun experience. But right after, what happened after that is what would have started my career, I guess, because right after that, I ended up, Snoop wanted to go out. He had to go out on tour. He had a tour that he was going out, and he decided he wanted to take a live band out. So he just took us out.
He took the band that you had?
Yeah. He took us out, and it was cool. And we discovered we had a little leeway in the situation. And I was the keyboard player, so I kind of was the silent music director.
I was going to ask about that, what role you played. I got the idea that you were sort of the MD and everything but name.
Yeah, well, you know, the real guy was his cousin, or the guy, one of the hype men. He never played, but he was the guy that kind of produced most of those records. His name was Superfly. But Superfly had trust in me, so he would be like, oh, man, he would entrust the rehearsals and stuff. He wouldn't even show up. He'd be like, he'd show up at first, and then he'd be like, y'all got it. You just handle it. You know, so, I mean, like, and we, me and Terrace Martin both was there. We were the ones that were outspoken about music arrangements and stuff like that, and influencing other musicians to join the band. Because at one point, we had Kamasi Washington, Ryan Porter, Keon Harold, all these guys was in the band. You know, and it was really a cool experience, you know.
And were you playing to tracks during a lot of that period?
We played to this thing called the Instant Replay, which, for the DJ, was the easiest job in America. You know, all you had to do was push play. And we played to it. Yeah, we played to what you would call a track.
Yeah, because, there are certain, like, you know, especially with a lot of his earlier music, there's certain bass sounds and sound effects that people, I think, expect to hear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they just, you know, most rappers, most hip-hop artists have have a need to hear the record as is. You know, they like the live elements, but they like the contrast between both. You know, and they have the need to hear the records, and some artists can't perform without hearing those sounds. Right. So yeah, so I would say that.
You're with him probably 10 years or something, right? Like
off and on, yeah. I mean, like, the last gig I did with him was maybe 2013 or something like that.
Wow.
Couple years ago.
Pretty recently. How did he develop as a performer and band leader during the time you were with him?
I think he learned a lot about musicians. I think most artists look at musicians as hired help, but I think he did that in the beginning. But I think in the end, he gained and earned, you know, a lot of respect was earned and for our musicianship. And I think he really respects us for who we are, you know, and as an asset.
And you did the Rock the Mic tour with him.
Yeah, I did.
Back in 2003?
I think I might have did a few of those things.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely did that.
Yeah. Which was the one 150 was on.
Yeah.
I actually saw that in Massachusetts. That
really?
Yeah.
That was, we played with 50 too.
Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff I want to ask about that show. I'll try to limit it to one or two things. First off, that tour, at least when it passed through Massachusetts, was right when Get Rich or Die Trying came out.
Right.
And every song on that album was on the radio. And he was the hottest thing on earth. What, from your perspective, what was that like to be around?
Oh, it was cool. You know what? Honestly, during that time period, playing with Snoop, he was the most popular guy. He was the coolest guy, no matter whether he had the number one hits at the time. He was the guy everybody wanted to be friends with. So for that reason, we met everybody. Everybody was in our dressing rooms. Everybody was coming through. You know, if that was during the time period where there were camera phones and stuff out, we would have had pictures with everybody, you know. But I think that was during the time when the disposable cameras and stuff
right,
was out.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But we had a chance to meet a lot of people, you know. But I think for me, 50 Cent wasn't my guy, even though it was when we met Busta Rhymes. So he was on that tour too.
Yeah.
We met Busta Rhymes. That was like, for me, that was just, yo, you know, I've died and gone to heaven. But and Jay-Z as well, because he was on that tour. But 50 Cent, you know, he was up and coming. Actually, he was, I mean, even though that was a big record, he still was establishing himself
right
as an, you know, as an entity, and it was a beautiful thing to watch. But it was actually fun to play his music. He was really down to earth and cool, so you didn't really have this idea that he was such a, you know, icon, you
right.
know, at the time.
Yeah. So you do this thing where you're, you know, sitting in with a few different artists, maybe a few songs with them on this tour, including Jay-Z.
Yeah.
Not long afterwards, Jay-Z does a record with a live band, the Unplugged record. And
first the bad boys break up. Every day I wake up, somebody got a problem with hope. What's up? Cats all fed up because I got a little cheddar and my record's moving out the store. I got young cats getting at me, young rappers spitting at me. My homie Big with it in this thing exactly. More money.
And started not long after that touring with live musicians. Do you see a link there? Do you see any kind of influence he had from maybe working with you guys?
I definitely see that. I wouldn't say us maybe, but definitely Snoop actually probably is the one that influenced a lot of that. A lot of guys, when they saw Snoop doing it and they saw how he was doing it, I think a lot of guys was like, wow, man. Yeah, that's the energy, you know. And a lot of guys kind of jumped on that bandwagon, I think. So I would say Snoop would be the reason why a lot of the guys were doing that, you know.
Nice. And you did some production work for Snoop.
Yeah, there's a record called Rhythm and Gangsters. And Snoop actually let the band, who was called the Snoopadelics, he let the band produce like two or three songs.
Do you remember which ones?
I really don't.
Okay.
It was like First Pair of Panties.
Or you could show me.
Freakily peek, let a nigga sneak a view. Peekaboo, let's see what we can do. I'm about freaking you and sneaking you into a quiet place so I can look at it face to face. Let me guess, you prefer to wear cotton. I can tell.
Me and Terrace was on that one. It's, you know, I don't remember.
Okay.
That was such a long time ago. But yeah. Yeah, well, we got a chance to do like production, which led into, you know, working with the Dog Pound, Daz.
I was
going to
say, you work with that whole sort of extended family of you know, Dog Pound and, you know, Warren G and Nate Dogg and even, you know, Uncle Charlie Wilson.
Yeah.
Among his sort of extended crowd, what was that whole crew kind of like to work with?
It was cool. You know, the thing, like, Daz is a musician.
What does Daz play?
Well, they're producers. They all play keys, and they, Daz produces all his own music.
Oh,
they all work for Death Row.
Right.
You know, as beat makers and producers. And, you know, Battle Cat, same way. All these guys, they were just so cool. They were like us. They were just icons, you know, because they were a part of the West Coast hip-hop history, you know. But they were just like us, you know. They were just, you know, they had their way of doing things, very innovative, which led us to meeting people like DJ Quick and those guys as well, you know.
Wow. Quick, former guest on the show. Great, obviously underrated and classic producer.
Yeah, I mean, he's like the guru for frequencies and mixing, you know, the sound of West Coast hip hop back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I guess more generally, I wanted to talk about playing hip hop live, which is like you're playing drum parts that aren't originally played by a drummer. They're either programmed on an MPC or, you know, sampled and chopped or whatever.
Right.
Is it ever difficult to recreate on an actual drum set parts that maybe weren't created with that in mind?
Yeah, it is, because when people are creating, they're not thinking about, I have two arms and two feet, you know.
Yeah.
They're not thinking that way. They're hearing rhythms and they're hearing sounds and they're pushing record, you know, so... It's like, essentially, you know, you find a lot of times it is difficult because you find, you're like, how the hell am I gonna play all of this? You know, it's like, I only have two of them. So you pick out the most important parts and you play them. And hopefully you have a percussion player that can double up and help you pull the stuff off, you know.
Right. Was Timbaland particularly tough in that regard? I feel like he would be. You worked with him for a while.
Nah, man, Timbaland was the most fun music to play, because Timbaland, again, he's like a guy that wishes he could play drums, so he gets it off on the thing.
Yeah.
And he really probably could play the hell out of some drums if he just had a drum set and just practice every day, because he has it. He has the rhythms, he has the ears for it. But man, his music was so much fun to play as a drummer. And yeah, that was some of the most fun I've had touring with him.
I'll bet. And you were kind of touring during Justin Timberlake's sort of long off period where he was acting, right. But you know, instead of recuperating or, you know, writing, he was popping up on stage with you all over the world.
Yeah. Yeah, we was playing Justin Timberlake's set almost half the time we was out with Timberland, you know. So, yeah, it was really cool.
What was that like? Because he's definitely, at least you get the impression he's a, you know, musician, plays keys and stuff like that.
Ooh, Justin? Yeah, JT. Yeah. You know, I gained a lot of respect for him, you know. Because, you know, before that, I was like, he's this cheesy guy singing this high notes for the girls and stuff, you know. But, I mean, that's just the stereotype musicians do, you know. Mm. But you get to meet him, and I remember the first rehearsal we had, and it was a sound check or something like that. Oh, no, it was a rehearsal. My bad. And he got on every instrument. And immediately, I don't know if that was, like, his thing where he was like, I'm going to let you guys know what I can do. But he got on every instrument, and he could play every instrument. And I was like, wow, man. So I gained a lot of respect for him immediately, you know, and all of the other stuff was out the window,
right.
You know, and all the stereotype and all that stuff was gone immediately.
And you once sort of, I don't know if this was, you let it slip or what, but you talked about how in the context of hip hop that you ended up, you called it ghost wrote a bunch of songs. And so people, I think, who are hip hop fans have an idea how ghost writing works in a lyrical context, right?
Yeah.
You bring in I didn't want to name names, but you bring in someone else to sort of write lyrics,
right.
Or someone else has. What does ghostwriting mean in a musical context in hip-hop?
Well, I mean, all over the world, not in a whole lot of instances, you know, musicians are coming up with their take on music or their take of the groove or that actually makes the record. And they just get paid for performing. But, you know, they actually come up with the process, you know. And that's actually one of the things that I'm studying now to, I do these things called tribute. I do these tributes and tribute the music, well, the drumming musicianship of Clyde Stubblefield, mm-hmm. who was known as the funky drummer from James Brown.
One, two, three, four, get it!
He's been sampled almost 500 times, and he's never received a check for anyone. So to me, in terms of ghost writing from a musician standpoint, I think that's just what we do all the time, you know, because there's so many it would be so many splits if you had to split it up with all of the guys that you hired to come in and play on the music that, you know, people are so glad to get the credit that it's a cancellation, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say I did that on a ton of records, you know.
Any ones you feel comfortable naming?
Well, I mean, you know, if I could, yeah, maybe on. I mean, be honest with you, like half the records that I've ever played on was like that, mm-hmm. You know, everything that don't say that
something,
everything that don't say that I produced, I feel that way about. Saying names might be a little weird, but
sure.
But yeah, I mean, every musician is gonna feel that way at some point when a song blows to smith, you know, and they know they had a part in it. You know?
This was something that I think reached public consciousness a few years ago when the Standing in the Shadows of Motown movie came out.
Yeah.
Right. And people started realizing, oh, the guy who plays the guitar riff on My Girl, you know, he didn't write that or whatever.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because what was it last year when the lawsuit ensued with Pharrell?
Mm-hmm. And the Blurred Lines lawsuit.
And Nona Gay. Well, Nona Gay won the lawsuit for the Gay family. If you look at the writing credits on the song, if you listen to the song, period, the only thing that was parallel to the two songs to me was the actual drum beat.
Mm-hmm.
right? The chords and all that stuff was different. The verb, the lyrics, all stuff was different. The only thing that made you feel like that was the other song was the actual drum beat.
Yeah.
But the drummer that wrote that part received not a dime.
Nothing, right. That's so interesting. You know,
yeah. And it's just a testament to I mean, like Marvin Gaye, and he's on the thing as a writer. Because yeah. On the thing is, Marvin Gaye played all the instruments on that song, but the drums.
The drums on Got to Give It Up were played by frequent Gaye collaborator Preston Bugsy Wilcox. He was also the drummer for the classic TV themes for Good Times and the Jeffersons.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but the one part that was actually ripped.
The one part that got him millions of dollars.
The one part that was actually ripped, that guy is still, you know, sitting in his house, you know, happy about being a part of the Marvin Gaye experience, you know, with none of that millions of dollars that was won.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's happening all the time. So this is like a thing. I mean, it's a thing for me to really expose that and see if we can change that, because it's really...
Yeah, it's the way songwriting works. And I know having talked to songwriters and stuff, it's so kind of like, who writes a song? It's not like there's a formula. It's just sort of people sit in a room and decide, okay, you wrote 40%. I'll say I wrote 60%.
Yeah, it's literally an agreement.
Yeah, right. There's not a right way of doing
not
a
really,
it.
It's not a system in place for musicians. It's in place only for the songwriter and the person that writes the music.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of changing tacks for a second, you're on two songs on To Pimp a Butterfly, the Kendrick Lamar album, uh-huh. Right? Doing drums on one and keys on the other. 40 acres in a mule, not a 40 ounce in a pit, poor, poor shit. Matador, had a door knocking, let him in. Who's that genitals best friend? Cause boo-boo, your own boy, you black that you're from. Boo-boo, little hoes you went to school with. Boo-boo, baby mama.
Well, I'm listed on two songs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm on the record pretty much the whole entire record.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What were those sessions like?
They were short and quick. It was, I mean, it literally went as, you know, Terrace will give us a time. Terrace was producing those records, you know, that album. And he would come up with these ideas and Kendrick would be like, okay, you know, see what you got, you know. And Terrence would be like, when can you be in the studio? Come in the studio, blah, 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 blah. What kind of drum set you want? Blah, blah, blah. I got a drum set. I'm going to bring my own drum set. You know, it's that kind of dialogue. And he was like, what time are you going to be there? And he's like, make sure you're there. You know, that kind of thing. And we get there. And then he has all this stuff in his head. Nobody knows what the hell he's going to come up, ask us to do. You know, then he just teaches the song on the spot. Something he came up with. You know, knowing Terrence too, just knowing him. You know, it don't take a lot of time for him to come up with genius ideas like that. You know, we practice producing and working on material a lot. And it's just something he's developed. And so a lot of those sessions, we go in and we cut the song. And Kendrick will walk in with his cell phone. And he'll film us and be like, yeah, you know. And you can tell it's... You know, you're doing the right thing, because he gets in the booth and he'll try to rap as you're cutting.
Wow.
You know.
Live to what the band is doing.
Yeah, we were cutting for free, for instance.
Right.
And we actually had that song. It's like a swing. It's like really intense bebop going on. And it was actually faster. It was like da 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 da, and we got done. When we got done the first couple of times, Terrence was like, you know, we were out of breath, man. We were like playing like the Miles Quintet or something, like in the '60s, and you know, and Terrence was like, it needs to be slower, and we did it slower, and we did it maybe like three or four takes, and Kendrick comes in on the second take. He walks in the studio on the second take and he's filming. He's loving what he's hearing. It's like totally different. And he's loving it and he's like getting in on his video, on his camera phone. And he asked the engineer Ali to set up a mic in the booth, in the engineering room. And so next thing I know, we counting the song off. Da 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 da. And his voice is coming in my earphones. with the famous line,
"This dick ain't free."
You know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah. And so
must have surprised you a little bit to hear that out of nowhere.
Yeah, it was like, I was like, you know, it took me a while to get it. And I was like, wait, this guy is freestyling off of us playing.
"You looking at me like it ain't a receipt, like I never made ends meet, eating your leftovers and raw meat. This dick ain't free. Living in captivity, raised my cap salary, celery, telling me green is all I need. Evidently all I seen was spam and raw sardines. This dick ain't free. I mean, baby, you really think we could make a baby name Mercedes without a Mercedes Benz and 24-inch rims, 5% tint and air conditioning vents? Hell fucking no. This dick ain't free. I need 40 acres and a mule."
And he's listening to my rhythms, and he's rapping off my rhythms on the drums. And that was crazy, you know. I mean, like, for the most part, he kept the dialogue from a freestyle. And he just went and just corrected some words. But that was pretty much the take.
Wow. That's,
you know, that's which amazing. Is incredible, yeah.
Yeah, that's such a wild session. And, you know, to have that record meet such, like, critical and kind of popular acclaim. Well, I mean, I guess you knew it'd be big because his last record was big. But what was it like to hear some of the stuff people ended up saying about that record?
No, because I saw when I was hearing the record and I was hearing the direction that he was allowing Terrace to take the record.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was going to, I mean, I knew that lyrically it was genius. But I my only concern was what was people going to take on the music, because it was this generation, the newer generation don't really get with that kind of music or with live instruments, you know?
Right.
So I was just nervous about that side of it. And when people overlooked the fact that they were getting influenced by John Coltrane and Miles Davis, and they actually enjoyed it. They enjoyed the sounds of it. All of the kids, they love it, man. And they want this new sound. It's very gratifying, you know. And Terrace did a really good job in that regard. I really feel like he, you know, we had this thing when we got to get the musicians back working. And that was it, you know. Now musicians can work again. You know, because everybody needs that sound.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, I wanted to get into stuff that's, you know, you're involved in currently, you know, some of the stuff that you're doing. You have a new label or imprint you're starting, yeah. RSVP.
Yes.
So what is that, and what is its relation to Rope-A-Dope, which is the sort of larger label?
Well, it's an imprint from Rope-A-Dope. The guy, Lewis Marks, who's the head of Rope-A-Dope, we sat down and came up with an idea to start an imprint, which would allow me to showcase and put out records of my, you know, of people that I work with and artists that I would sign and produce and stuff under that imprint. So the first project was the Ghost Note project, which is a band that I'm actually a part of that I'm. Co-founded with a guy named Nate Worth, because we play in a band called Snarky Puppy together, and it's like a side project of that, and yeah, and it's like a drum ensemble, pretty much a percussion ensemble.
And you have a solo record that you released just maybe a month and a half ago.
Yeah, we did a tribute to Martin Luther King.
"The King's speech to our ears has been the true gift. So I lift up my eyes to the sky far above the hate and lies, causing stereotypes to die while the voice of justice cries."
Yeah, what inspired that? It's not songs about him, it's songs that he liked.
Yeah.
Right? It's versions of songs that he would listen to or demand be in hotel rooms he stayed at,
yeah.
or venues he was about to speak at. Where did that whole idea come about?
Well, I thought, you know, I wanted to do a tribute to him, but I didn't want to. I wanted to do it from a musician standpoint. Like, what would be the perfect tribute musically, because that's all I can offer, you know. And so I had an idea. I was like, you know what? I wonder what music was inspiring him. You know, what was the music he listened to? What? And man, you look online and you type in, what was Martin Luther King's favorite songs, and 100 songs come up. And I was like, wow, this is it. I'll get a list of his favorite tunes. I'll cherry pick from it, and I'll do my own arrangements of these tunes, and I'll put a record out and tribute him, you know, with it, you know, tribute his legacy, you know, with it. So that's kind of how all that came about, and it was a really fun, interesting thing to do.
And, you know, I don't think a lot of our listeners really have an idea what it's like to be a working musician. You know, obviously you have projects like Ghost Note and Snarky Puppy that are where you're an integral part of the composition process, other acts that you tour with when they're available. Just to give us an idea of what your life is like, how far ahead is your calendar booked in general?
I mean, it used to be a year ahead. now, like when you're grinding, you know, it's longer. But now it's maybe like six to seven months ahead, which is still four to five months off of a year. But it helps. It's a big difference, you know, because now you can kind of see. When you're a year ahead, man, it's like you just, it's full. It just looks full, you know. But yeah, I mean, like you, and depending on, and then the thing about being a working musician is 50% plan. 50% is it, the business side is crazy. And you have to take care of your business. You have to meet your calendars. You have to answer emails. You have to know what, you have to mark things when you book it. When you take a gig, you have to know. You know, you got to have that stuff really organized.
Right. And booking one gig when you're on the road with another one, probably not that easy.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, you really have to get that side. And you make a lot of mistakes in the beginning, you know. But once you get it down, it becomes a little easier. But it's a lot of work, yeah. I'd say that.
And you did one of the biggest gigs in the world. Maybe 5-6 years ago, the Super Bowl.
Yeah. What gig is this?
Yeah. So what was that? It wasn't the halftime show, right? It was something else?
It was like the introduction to the Super Bowl week for festivities, which was called, it's called the Pepsi Smash, Super Bowl Pepsi Smash. And Rihanna performed on it. JoJo and Justin, it was Justin Bieber, pretty much his like coming out party.
And who here has Bieber fever?
Wow. Pretty much, yeah.
And you were a house band, or you performed?
No, it was performing with Timbaland, you know. Wow. Yeah, it was fun. And we had a hologram of Justin. It was really cool.
Wow, this is before holograms became a thing.
Well, it was during the same time, actually.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't really a hologram, but it was the closest thing. It was like the beginning of all of that stuff.
Right.
You know?
Right. And just, you know, one or two more things. I saw part of a video you did where you got to meet Clyde Stubblefield and Jabo Starks.
Like Stubblefield, Jabo Starks was a drummer for the James Brown Band. He played on many of Brown's most famous songs, including Licking Stick, Sex Machine, and Talking Loud and Saying Nothing. The two drummers played with Brown at the same time and remain close to this day.
Oh, yeah.
Where you got to sit down and interview them. What was that like? What was it to meet them in person, to hear them talk, to, you know, play with them, all that stuff?
Oh, man, it was overwhelming. First of all, I mean, like, you talk about fulfilling your lifelong dreams. That was definitely one that I couldn't have planned for myself, you know. These guys really influenced my drumming because that's the music that that was my favorite piece of music, you know. And so to meet them, I spent 3 days with them. We went and ate and talked and sat. And I just, man, they were so nice. They just gave me everything, man. They told me all sorts of stories that I could never repeat. And as well as just like the real deal, you know, like how they felt, how they lived, you know, like what it was like to be a black musician in that time period, from that to what it was like to be in a situation where you're playing with another guy. And to be that way, basically, when they both, and you hear Clyde say that he looked, you know, his favorite drummer was Jabbo, because Jabbo was playing with Bobby Blue Band back in the day.
And Jabbo was sitting in there. I says, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm the drummer." I said, "Oh, how long you been here?" He said, 2 weeks. I said, "Who would you play with before you came with Brown?" He said, "Bobby Brown." I said, "That's my number one drummer." And I got it. I says, I started taking everything from him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I loved him. He was the number one drummer I used to listen to with Bobby Bland.
Wow.
So he went auditioning for the James Brown, and it was seven other guys. So they both looked, they clicked, they hit it off, and they looked at each other, and they were like, "We got to get rid of some of these guys."
Right. I heard them talk about that, about how they, like, one by one picked off the other drummers.
Yeah, it was like, "We got to get rid of these guys. We got to get rid of this guy to be me and you."
Yeah.
And so they made a pact that it was just going to knock them off one by one, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really amazing story.
Amazing. I read somewhere that, you know, you've played all over the world, traveled all over the world. You got kidnapped once?
Oh, I wouldn't, yeah. I guess, yeah, that is the term. I was basically, I guess, you know, I was robbed in Dubai. I was on a layover flying to Africa to meet up with the band Snarky Puppy. And in a last minute change, I had to fly from a different city. Because we picked up a studio session, me and the band leader for Snarky Puppy and Corey Henry, picked up a last-minute session for Atlantic Records in New York. And we were going to be working until time to go to that, you know, festival in Africa. So they changed the ticket, so I had to fly through Dubai, which normally would have been ideal for me. Because I love Dubai, and it was like a 23-hour layover.
Oh, wow. So you actually get out, leave the airport.
Right. But because we were coming off tour, and we spent two extra days in the studio, I just was tired, you know. So I didn't want to go be in another city for a layover. I just wanted to go straight to the where I was supposed to be and just get into bed and, you know, just be there until time to do show and stuff like that. But anyways, make a long story short, I decided, I slept the whole day away and I woke up like at 12 o'clock at night. My flight was going to be like at 3 in the morning or 2:30 or something like that. I woke up at 12 and I was frantic. I was hungry and I was like, dang, I slept the whole day away. And so I got my things together. Get ready to go. I was like, on my way to the airport, I'm going to have to grab something to eat. So I talked to the concierge down in the front row and asked him, "Hey, man, I want to get something to eat." And they was like, "Well, you go 5 minutes that way. There's tons of fast food places. You go 5 minutes this way, it's the airport. But to get to that street, you have to walk down this dark street for 10 minutes. You have to walk down till you see the light. And when you see the light, make a left. And then 5 minutes to the right, it's fast food. 5 minutes to the left is the airport." So I was like, okay, cool. You know, I'm walking down, you know, this dark street. And I see, it was funny, I see a guy walk towards me. And I was just a grown man. He looks like he was crying. And, you know, I had my headphones on. So I was like, okay. Dude's crying. You know, I was wondering, is it okay? And so I walk a few more feet up, and I see these guys across the street hanging out. I don't want to be like stereotypical, but they look like, you know, guys, Middle Eastern guys that were like hip Middle Eastern guys. Like they were, one had a tank top on, and, you know, they didn't look like their culture, you know. As far in terms of dress, you know, they were dressed like they were American hip hoppers, you know. So, you know, I looked and I saw him and we made eye contact, and he looked up and he looked at me, he stared at me, and he threw his they were drinking a bottle of beer, I guess. He threw it down on the ground, and he kind of me-mugged me a little bit. And then he started walking over towards me. There's like five of them. So he started walking over towards me, and I was like, yo. You know, I was like, okay, I'm just going to mind my own business, keep going. And so as they got closer, I was like, I was trying to greet, you know, what's up? You know, is everything cool? You know, and they asked me if I had money. And basically, to make a long story short, they robbed me. They tried to take money from me. I didn't have any money. I just had my credit cards. And it kind of ticked them off that I didn't have American cash, you know. So he slapped me around and kept hitting me. And before I knew it, I was in the fight, you know. And I couldn't handle four or five guys, you know. So I went down to the ground and pretended as if I was unconscious. And in a sense, it probably saved my life. But I thought they would just stomp me out and leave me there, you know. But, you know, the two guys started having an argument. And I couldn't hear that they were speaking another language. And I couldn't hear what they were. Really what it was about, you know, but I couldn't understand it. And one guy left, pissed off, you know, obviously. And the other guy turns it to two other guys and was like, let's get him in the car. And so I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, oh, shit, you know, I might not have wanted to play unconscious. Right. Maybe I should wake up, you know. And fight again, you know. But ironically, it was just the weirdest thing because he put me in the back seat. I'm thinking the whole time, like, I can't open my eyes, you know, because I don't want them to think, you know, like, I'm thinking they're going to put me in the trunk because usually that's what happens.
Right.
You know, so he put me in the back seat, you know, and it's like a guy, I'm sitting in the back seat and I'm laying down to my right. And there's a guy on the left side behind the driver's seat. Look, and he's in the back seat with me. And then there's one other guy in the front as a passenger. And then there's the driver, the guy that slapped me around. He was like the boss or the ringleader. And so I just started, you know, honestly, I just started praying. I was like, God, this can't be the end of my life. I was like, give me a window of opportunity and I'll take it. And I saw red, man. I just started getting angry. I was never nervous. I was never afraid. I was never mad until at one point, and I saw the dude look out the window, and I kicked my way out. I kicked and scratched and did all I could do, and until the car slowed down, you know, the car started going, and I started just thinking, I can't go too far in this car or I'm gonna die.
Right.
And so I just started fighting for my life, and I managed to get the car, the driver, to slow down enough for me to jump out the car. I jumped out the car and ran for my life. And got about 10 feet and realized I couldn't run and gave up. You know, my ankle was, everything was just really messed up. So I gave up and I turned around. I just knew they were behind me, chasing after me. And man, they were beat pretty bad. I just saw red, so I don't really know. I can't really recall
right.
every actual part of the moment, but man, they were trying to get out of there.
Wow.
And luckily, there was a taxi driver that saw most of my struggle, and he waited for them to leave and came back and helped me. Yeah, it was very rough. I got out of there with a sprained ankle. My arm was sprung too as well. You know, I had to wear a sling for a few, maybe almost a week, and then I had a black eye, a very black eye, you know, but and a few scratches, and that's it.
Wow.
You know, that's it. You know,
amazing.
I'm very grateful that was it.
Yeah.
You know, because I was back playing. Almost a month and a half later. I was playing 2 months later, actually.
Wow. And just one or two quick things. You know, we've talked a lot about the magnet school you were in and some of the people, players you grew up with. You know, we talked about the school and kind of how it produced great musicians. What do you think it is about the Dallas scene or about that city in particular that, you know, players keep coming out of there?
What do you think about, well, it's, man, it's bred it. Musicians for years, man. Ceta Walton, Fats, David Fathead Newman, Dewey Redman, who is Joshua Redman's father, Johnny Taylor, Steve Ray Vaughan was born there, Buddy Miles lived there, Carnell Dupree is from Fort Worth. Like the list goes on, bro. Like all these you know, Bernard Wright lived there for so long. And so you think of Lucky Peterson, all these guys are there in the city. And it's just so much music and so many genres, so many different places, you know, different areas of music that you can go to for live music. And so the scene there was cultivated and it was really live, you know. And so as kids, we were growing up into this stuff. And you grew up in your environment. And then the next generation grows up in the same environment. And it just goes on and on and on. And now it's just saturated with so many musicians with no outlet. You know, with not many outlets in the city anymore, because it's just so many. You know, it's the number one city for, I'm not sure if I'm accurate for this year, but for a long time it was the number one city for wedding bands. I had the highest grossing wedding bands and top 40 bands in the city. So it's just so much music in that city, and I think that's why. And you know, it has a very deep, rich background in blues, hip hop, and gospel. I think that's why. You know, and jazz too, but you know, all of that kind of plays itself in the same area.
Yeah. And finally, something I've been dying to ask, what was it like to play Butterfly Kisses every night?
Oh, with all that I've done wrong, I must have done something to deserve a hug every morning and butterfly kisses at night.
I should know you did a tour with Christian tour with Bob Christian music tour with Bob Carlisle.
Yeah.
And number one wedding song of and all time.
Twilight Paris and Jars of Clay. Yeah, I mean, I was actually out with God's Property when that happened. And, yeah, we sung that song with them every night. And wow, we got to just play with them, you know. And it was cool. I mean, at the time, I didn't know that song. You know, I was a kid still, you know. I didn't know that song was like what I know it to be now, you know. And so it just, you know, when you're a kid, man, you take a lot of stuff for granted, you know. I see it now and I say that. And people be like, whoa, for real? You know, I'm like, yeah. So, you know, and then you realize, oh, the magnitude of what it was, you know?
Nice. Well, thanks so much for hanging out and giving
Thanks, man. Some
time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for giving Dallas love, too, man. That's incredible, you know?
I've gotten the opportunity over the past few months to talk not only to Sputt, but to several of his peers and friends in the Dallas musician community. And whatever's in the water over there, which I'll be puzzling through in an upcoming article for The Observer, by the way, it makes not only for world-class musicians, but also for great and gracious people. Several hours after this interview, I got a chance to see Sputt play with his new group Ghost Note at a club in Manhattan. And if you ever get the chance to see him play, whether it's with Ghost Note, Snarky Puppy, or even Snoop Dogg, I can't recommend it highly enough. Join us next week when our guest will be Keith Shockley of the classic Bomb Squad production team, with his brother Hank, their cousin Eric Sadler, and a whole crew of associates. Keith played a key role in albums by Public Enemy, Ice Cube, and others that changed hip-hop forever. We talk plenty about that, of course, but also about the early mobile DJ scene in New York, performing at talent shows emceed by a young Eddie Murphy, helping Bill Biv DeVoe find their image and create Poison, and much more. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. Don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro,
a guy that wishes he could play drums.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He's like the guru for frequencies.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
You know, all you had to do was push play.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He like kind of just innovated the gospel genre.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
They were so nice. They just gave me everything, man.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Benjamin Bray.
And he'll try to rap as you're cutting.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
I mean, I've been an advocate for Dallas for a long time, but I'm partial to it because I'm from there.
Right.
But, you know, and I've always tried to just put all the musicians that I could think of, just and get them involved in everything I was trying to do.